Welcome to Business Game Changers, where you'll hear expert tips on the big issues and the hottest trends to level up your business game. If you're building a career or building a business, this is Must Hear Radio. Here's your host, Sarah Westall.
Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall. Well, espionage is on the rise. We have legions of professional spies that are coming out of the NSA and a lot of different government agencies that are very well trained. They have a high level skills and they're eager to sell their services to the business world. And on top of that, we have a much more competitive worldwide environment where companies coming from other countries have different ethics and different, they just do things differently. Some countries are much more shady in their business practices, and we have to compete against that. So has there become a spy economy? Has it gotten to that point? Well, Brian O'Shea, the CEO of Stryker Pierce, believes it has, and that the whole industry is changing, and that there is a large demand for the types of services that he provides, which is intelligence collection and investigations for private clients. He brings his 20 years experience of investigative intelligence and counterintelligence field work to businesses. He has worked for various multiple U.S. intelligence agencies and has helped many CEOs and members of Middle Eastern royal families and foreign governments around the world. It should be a really interesting talk with him about how this whole economy is changing and growing and how it's affecting businesses and how they can compete. But before we get into that, we're going to talk to Tom Shepard, who is the CEO of Shepard Financial, and we're going to do a much more in-depth talk today on how to evolve with your money. He has informed us on the different natures, but now he's going to bring that together and show how it affects relationships and how we can use the understanding of our relation of our natures to affect the decision making that we do. So for now, let's welcome Tom Shepard to the program.
Hi, Tom. Welcome back to the show again.
Hi. How are you?
Doing great. Well, we've covered
you having a good.
Oh,
you having
go
a good
ahead.
Summer?
Oh, I'm always having a good summer. Summer's my favorite time. I just love it. I can sit and look outside the windows, and it's awesome. But I'm in the middle of the woods, so I'm on 10 acres of land, so I'm right in the middle of it. I love it.
Cool.
Okay, well, we've covered a lot of ground over the last few weeks. Can you summarize what we should have learned by now?
Sure, I can take a stab at that. So for the last several weeks, we've been going through what we call the seven human natures. This is terminology and language that for us describes how each person is one of seven hardwired archetypes. Not a big fan of the word, but every person came into this world with a certain nature. The names for those seven natures are easy to remember, hopefully for people, because we connect them to familiar financial relationship terms. And the reason we chose doing it with financial relationship terms isn't because I'm in the financial services business, but it's because financial is connected more closely than the other things we value, time, relationships, our health. It's more closely related to value terminology. So our language is full of things that are relating to money terms. Like even when it comes to time, we oftentimes will say, you know, I spent my time doing something.
Well, we're pretty much a money culture.
Yeah.
And we really are.
That's what makes it possible for us to take that language and build something incredibly powerful with it. So the natures again, And sometimes I insert different words. So if you've listened to the last 4 or 5 shows and I use a different word, I apologize, but you know, we're still editing the book. So, you know, it's not yet set in stone, but, the natures are taker, spender, worker, saver, investor, lever, and giver. And all of those terms are neutral terms. There's no hierarchy, but there is an order to it.
Oh, there's an order. Okay.
Yeah. So there's no hierarchy. I can't say that a giver is better than a lever or a worker is better than a spender.
And whatever you know, I am is better than whatever you are.
Yeah, that
doesn't
that,
work that way.
No, there's no hierarchy. However, you know, if I want to grow and develop horizontally, so maybe I'm my natural state is I'm a worker, but I want to do things that require me to get better at spending or saving or investing or giving or even taking. You know, I know people who are terrible at receiving.
Sure.
So if I want to become well-rounded, then maybe that's the way I need to work on developing a second nature or a third nature. My role or my responsibilities might give me the opportunity to develop horizontally. And so that's the place where most of us are trying to achieve success. We learn that in school, you know. My kids are in high school, 2 of them. And, you know, the whole idea is to have a well-rounded resume. The other way to grow is vertically. In other words, you know, my nature might be that I'm a worker, but I want to be a good worker, or I want to be a better worker, or I want to be the best worker I can possibly be.
And so we might just want to really perfect what we're good at.
Right. And so what's interesting is in order for me to become the best possible worker, I actually have to get support for myself in getting outside of my comfort zone. And my comfort zone's as a worker. So to be a better worker, I have to understand that there are other tools that human beings can access. So if I'm a worker, I need to understand that sometimes I don't need to spend every last second. I might actually need to create some space, which savers love to do. Or I might need to create some money, which savers like to do. And I might need to do something with that money that leverages my resources so that I can get more of something and then take that and spend it differently so that I can be a better worker.
Makes sense.
And so I just used all of those words in a sentence that took you to a better worker.
Well,
that's what we call the evolution of the self, is growing horizontally in a way that allows you to access vertical growth.
Well, let's say we've all taken your free assessment and we learn kind of what we probably are. I suppose it's not a perfect assessment tool unless it gets really in depth. But what do you recommend that we do with that knowledge? How do we move forward from that?
Well, I took my own little test and I know that I'm a lever. And did you take it?
I did take it. I'm an investor.
So you're an investor. I'm a lever. So if I actually
there is a hierarchy. My investor is better than your lever.
Right. Yes, it flows in reverse. So you know, if I want to actually become a better lever, then I need to know what lever I am. So the next step would be for you or me to try to figure out what state of lever am I. So what kind of investor are you? And then we go back to using terms that come out of the first 7 relationships. So these are what we call the levels or states. You know, we can come up with a broad term to describe them, but here's how this language goes. So if you have say you want to invest some money, but you don't have any. Not only do you not have any, but you don't, you're not even anywhere near going to have any.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
So you have, in order to invest, you have insufficient resources to invest.
Okay.
Now, let's say some, over time, you might run into some money, but you're not necessarily good at holding on to it, so it comes and goes.
Because I'm always investing in things or something. I'm not being smart about it.
As an investor, you might be wanting to invest in things, but when you have lots of money, you might think that, oh, hey, I got lots of money, so I can speculate and I can take lots of risk, and then all of a sudden you don't have a lot of money and you wish you had.
But, and this can also be an investor of time and things like that as well, right?
Right. So we, later on, we'll talk about the different things that people value and how you can use this same pattern recognition to look at your health and your relationships. But it's easiest for us to keep it simple by talking about one dimension, which is money. So the second name is sufficient. I have sufficient resources because over time I may run across amounts of money that I could invest. But then maybe I can't invest because I run into other periods where I don't have enough. And so you might be an investor who's frustrated because you're in an insufficient state, but really because you do but don't, it's really sufficient, but over time. If you get to a point where you always have just enough, and so you're always on the cusp of being able to invest some money, but you never get around to it, it's because you're efficient, but you're not yet proficient at saving the money that you need to invest.
Sure, okay.
All right, so insufficient, sufficient, efficient, proficient. In order for you to invest, you need to be productive. You need to be able to save the money, and then you got to have an idea what you want to put it into
and you have to be
get
a pretty,
something out of it.
You have to be a decent worker to be able to work hard to get that money, and you have to be able to do other things.
Yeah, you have to be, even though you're an investor, you have to figure out how to take your money, spend it wisely, earn enough, save some so you can invest. And so you have to get to that place. And as an investor, you just want to invest. And when people don't realize that you have to work up to it, they might be in a state trying to aspire to a nature that they try to skip steps. So that's where I say there's an order to it, even though there isn't a hierarchy.
Oh, I see. That makes sense. You have to build up to being able to take advantage of some of these things that you have.
Right.
Well, and that maybe comes to your values. You also emphasize values. How does that fit into the equation?
So let me just say, as an investor, how would you become a better investor? You wanted to stop an investor because you figured that was the peak, that was the pinnacle, that's the ultimate. But levers above
I'm just
that,
giving
right?
you. Yeah. I'm giving you crap.
So the term for the lever is deductive. The term for investor was productive. The term for lever was deductive. The problem is most people use leverage to make things, to try to do more rather than try to make things easier. And then the seventh state is inductive. So when we talk about how can I be an inducted investor, it's the investor who really finally gets the need to do all seven things in order to continue to be a good investor and do things with the money that makes life easier so that they have more and more and more to give in their other value realms.
So
health,
they could become a
give,
they could
time.
Become a giver with their investing and things like that. More well-rounded.
Right. Right. So they're all neutral terms. There's no hierarchy, but there is an order. And so if I'm a lever, but I know my state of level of lever is, insufficient, then I know who I am and I know what I need to work on. And I need to work on it from my position of strength, which is I need to acknowledge that I'm a lever. And every nature has like I said, there's neutral, but there are strengths and then there are also weaknesses. So there are ways each nature can become distorted. And distorted is, you know, there's a good distortion and then there's a bad distortion.
And basically it's just out of perspective and out of whack to what it is that you're trying to get accomplished.
Right. So each of those natures, the distortion has a name. So if I'm a worker who works way too much and has nothing else, you know, I don't exercise, I don't eat well, I'm all just work. That's called a workaholic.
That's called somebody waiting to have a heart attack.
right. If I'm a saver and all I do is save, we call that type of person a hoarder, an investor that gets, you know, way overzealous. We can call that a speculator. A lever who tries to do more and more and more rather than make things easier and easier and easier. You know, the name for that, we could call them a debtor. A giver that gives and gives and gives and gives and never bothers to take anything. We call them martyr. So every nature has a dark side.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I hear somebody who's a guru out in the world and I understand what their nature is, I have to think critically about where are they coming from, because there might be a dark side. And
yeah.
They might not know it.
Interesting.
They might be a little unaware of how their emphasis on their nature creates potentially stumbling blocks for somebody who's trying to implement, you know, their plan or their rules.
And that's where a lot of the friction can come from.
Yes. Yep.
So let's get back to my values question. How does that fit into the equation?
So there are four things that every person values: time, stuff, material things. Money falls into that category. Health and relationships. And if I have the right language for how I value those things, and I understand myself and I understand that there are other people out there who have different natures and speak differently, then I can tune into what I value better and I can tune into what they value better, and we can make better trades that put us in a win-win situation.
And just understanding where the values are at. You also have, and I'd like to talk about this the next time you come on the show, but you talk about knowledge and wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a richer yet simpler path. It says, why is knowledge and wisdom a richer yet simpler path?
So, you know, when we use the term knowledge, I can know a lot, but be doing nothing with it. That's not what people want. They actually want to be able to do something with it. But, you know, in our sort of way of thinking about this, it's like having one of the coordinates, and you need the second one before you're motivated to figure out what the next step is. And so if I know what my nature is and I know what state I'm in, then I can find myself on a map and I can figure out where I need to go, because I just need to go to the next place.
Basically being just a cleaner, simpler approach is richer and you can get more accomplished.
Yeah. Wisdom, knowledge is one of the coordinates. Wisdom is having the second coordinate and seeing the whole map. Wisdom always comes with a context.
And you're going to dive. Well, you're going to dive into these things in more detail in the coming weeks, right? So we're just giving a little glimpse over this, and then you're going to come in and talk about it in more detail.
Yeah, we. Here's the thing. I mean, this is so simple. But it's so simple, but it's complicated to explain without drawing Yeah. So part of our
And that's the whole thing. Any with the science or math or design or anything that you think about, the cleanest, simplest things are usually the best. You know, the most direct paths are usually the best. But it's kind of complicated to understand. Once you understand it, it's very simple.
Right. I was working with the guy who's helping us write the book, Beyond the Guru, and he was like, I'm not getting it. And part of the reason was because I kept using, different words to describe, worker, you know, worker, striver, somebody, you know, you start using different, I once was on a lacrosse team and they were all new to me, and this guy was introducing me to everybody, and everybody had a first name, a last name, and a nickname. I thought there were three times as many people on the team as there actually were.
Well, when you first enter a thing, words are so important when people are talking. And I used to do this design work for, you know, system design work, and we had to analyze words and get everybody on the same page. And it is amazing the definition that people have for different words and how that creates completely different perspectives. But
the first question on our survey is, you know, where do you go to save? And those who say the bank can't believe that somebody else would say, you know, Costco or Walmart, you know. And
I would say Costco or Walmart because I'm in the middle of raising kids and, okay, well, how do I spend the least I can?
Right. So, you know, that might be your role coming into the first question, but after seven questions, it's much more about the consistency of how you answer the questions than it is any one particular question. And so that's just amazing to me that people just don't have the same vocabulary, because we can talk about the seven spiritual laws of success. So that's Deepak Chopra. We can talk about Covey's seven habits of highly effective people. We can talk about the seven chakras, and we can talk about the seven natures. But for each one of those things to be connected to a common language that makes all of it accessible, that's what we're after, and that's what we're trying to do through your show, is help people sort of understand themselves and begin to tap into the wisdom that these other books can offer, but do so in a way that translates it into something that you're maybe actually well-versed in.
Well,
if you're well-versed in time management, then health can be more accessible if you understand the translations.
Well, this is interesting. I'm excited to keep digging into this stuff because it's really helpful for people to understand just how to be more zen with what's going on, for lack of a better word. You know, just more natural to who you really are, and then know how to. And that's about, you know, I've done a lot of coaching with high level athletes, and just learning how to get to that next level of, you know, that's about controlling your mind and controlling everything. Ends up being it. Yeah, you have to get better skill wise, but so much of it is mental after a certain point, and it's the same thing.
I grew up playing lacrosse, and so much of learning to use your offhand, the second nature hand, so much of that was, you know, just being willing to let your ego go and do it no matter how stupid you look.
That's a big part of it. When you're trying to learn it, when you're supposed to be really good at something, you have certain skills that you just don't want to do because you're bad at it. And you have to let that go. And my daughter's a pretty good little hockey player, and she doesn't have very good, she's 14. So she's working on her slap shot, for example. And she was just so embarrassed to work on it because it was bad. And she had to get, and her coach did a great job forcing her to just do it. You know, now she's past that whole embarrassment section.
Yeah.
And now she can get better now.
I was a defenseman in high school and college, and now I play attack, and I'll always have a defenseman who comes up against me. If he doesn't know me, he'll come up and be like, how do you know where
to the best,
so that it pisses me off?
That's the best.
Because I used to play your position.
Oh, yeah. That's why it's good to rotate and play all these different positions.
It is, and you know, Gretzky's all about multiple sports, and the coach down at Duke is about multiple sport athletes, and this whole idea of specialization is something that we will bring up and talk about as we go along as well.
Well, in today's world, people get so caught up in that because it's so competitive in sports, and you just got to make sure you don't do it. You can't do it completely ever, really, but you got to, especially when they're young and developing, that's the worst thing, is to specialize when they're 9, 10, 11, 12, when their body is developing. But I could have a whole conversation about that, too.
yeah, we could. So.
Okay, well, good. Well, you have a wonderful day, and I look forward to having you back.
Oh, I can't wait to come back.
Okay, great.
We'll talk to you later.
Again, if you want to get any contact information on the guests that I have on the program, including Tom Shepard, go to my website at sarahwestall.com, and you can get that information there. You can also read, or you can also learn about Tom Shepard at his website at shepardfinancial.com. And if you have not taken the assessment yet on what your nature is likely to be, go to his website and figure that out. Now we are going to welcome Brian O'Shea to the program, and he's going to educate us on the rise of the spy economy.
Hi, Brian. Welcome to the show.
Hi. How are you this morning?
I'm doing great. And I have some really interesting, or you're really interesting, so I have some questions for you. I'm going to dig right in. First of all, what is the riskiest or most dangerous situation that you've been involved in?
Well, that is a really, really interesting question. I would say probably the most physical, risky situation I've been involved in investigating corporate crimes. About 2 years ago, I was down just south of Sao Paulo in Brazil at a construction equipment company. They were concerned that their own people may have been selling out their schematics, their tier one EPA solutions, possibly to the competition. So we went in there undercover. I won't tell you what the cover was, but they did believe that we'd probably make a big investment in their company.
Mm-hmm.
So while wearing microphones and hoping the meeting had been set up, we realized that it had not. So in walks these very large construction salesmen in Brazil. And I'm sitting there, and I look down in my pocket, and I see my red light blinking in my recorder. And they just stare at us, and it's a very, very tense situation. Until I noticed that one of the salesmen had a Florida Gators pen. So I used that as a conversation piece and found out that he loved Miami. We started talking about Florida. Everyone relaxed. And we carried on with the interview to collect the evidence we needed for the client.
So you were worried that you were going to get exposed and not make it out of there.
And, yeah, absolutely. Go ahead.
And do you do that often? Is that how you do go undercover quite a bit?
Yeah, we do a lot of undercover. What we call that is counter corporate espionage. So what will happen a lot is a lot of corporations are spending a lot of money right now on cyber infrastructure, which is extremely important, especially in light of recent activities that we've all seen on the news with the Astros, the Sony hack, and, you know, the latest hack on the OPM, the largest database of government clearances. So with everyone spending time on that, what I've recognized is that really no one pays attention to social engineering and social hacking. So companies hire me after they've spent this money or before they're going to spend this money on their cyber infrastructure to really find out where the other holes are. So typically we'll go in, we will basically recruit assets unwittingly, meaning we get people to work for us under different guises. They normally think they're doing some outside consulting. And we get them to tell us everything about their company. And we're not talking about passwords. We're not talking about IP addresses. We're talking about needle-moving business stuff, such as next year's strategic plans, what the morale is around the board with the new executive, you know, what they're going to be launching at a trade show. That's the stuff we're after, because what I found in my past experience working in and around, you know, different corporate or competitive intelligence companies, those are the things that tough competitors want to know.
Yeah, they want to figure out how to scoop what you're doing and get there right first or mess you up, right?
Exactly. Either scoop you or mess you up. You hit it right on the head.
And so those are the biggest issues, essentially, that you're seeing in corporate espionage right now?
Those are the biggest, I would say those are the biggest intelligence topics that people are after. The biggest issues I'm seeing is there's a blurring of the line in between what is competitive intelligence and what is corporate espionage. So competitive intelligence, you know, it's a legal, respected, and I think necessary field. Of course you want to know what your competitors are doing. That's fair business. However, there's so many people flooding into the field of competitive intelligence that competition is stiff. I mean, this is a multi-million dollar industry now.
Well, and what would you say is, I don't mean to cut you off, but what is competitive intelligence? I mean, that would be just looking, doing legal stuff, like seeing public documents and stuff, not going in as a undercover, right?
Right, exactly. So competitive intelligence by its own definition, and I definitely will be paraphrasing here, but that's really just collecting all open source and legally obtained data about your competitor so you can better position yourself in the market against a product, an enterprise, a competitor, or a team. Completely legal. There's nothing wrong with that at all. When I was in the military, you never went into battle without collecting intelligence first. That's fine. But what happens is people are so interested and so hungry to impress their clients to get that other contract. What I started seeing in that field is there's a lot of players out there that are either pushing, blurring, or stepping over the line of that 1996 Corporate Espionage Act, Industrial Espionage Act. And that is the problem I'm seeing. And it gets even more dangerous now because with all the drawdowns that we're seeing, not only in the United States, but around the world of intelligence communities, with people's clearances being basically compromised due to such as hacks, those type of things. What's happening is you have highly trained intelligence professionals from many countries flooding into the market. And really, what skills do they have to market but that of collecting intelligence? And there's not many other things they can do. I mean, don't get me wrong, a lot of them can do a lot of different things, but what they know and what they're comfortable with is collecting intelligence. And so what I found is that with that happening, companies are so focused on cyber, they don't realize there are literally hundreds of thousands highly trained intelligence professionals that need work, and they're going to find work for somebody.
And they're coming in from other countries, would you say, or are they mostly from here doing it?
No, other countries and here. So competitive intelligence is normally afforded. It could be afforded by any company depending on, you know, what offering you're offering and what the price of that is. But most companies are multinational. I mean, everything is globalized. So we've seen everything from the Middle East, India, the UK, the United States, Canada. I mean, competitive intelligence companies are everywhere. And most companies, especially those large cap companies, you know, they do have divisions across the world, Southeast Asia, Australia to be included, Americas, South America. So that's why it's an international field.
What does the Espionage Act cover? The 96 Espionage Act?
In a nutshell, and really to just break it down in really basic terms because I don't have it memorized, but, you know, the thing you want to remember is you can never hire an active employee of the company you're targeting and pay them money for information. You can never misrepresent yourself as a bank or as a hedge fund using a fake name and, you know, get information that way. You cannot pose as a law enforcement official to get information. And we're seeing all sorts of stuff like that. Not so much law enforcement officials, but we are seeing very aggressive, I guess what I call aggressive pretexting. So in the basic form, those type of activities do or may cross the line of the Economic Espionage Act.
Well, how does one manipulate someone else to gain information? What are you seeing in some of the tactics?
Well, that's a longer conversation, but I'll try to definitely give you a couple examples. Really what happens a lot is, you know, people who are looking for work, for instance, they may put their resumes out there and they so desperately want a job. You know, people may pose as recruiters and get them talking to them. You know, tell me about your experience. Oh, this is interesting. It says at your last job that you're working on these kind of things. What was that like? That sounds really interesting. Well, really, what that bad actor in competitive intelligence is doing is they're essentially focused on that company that they found on that person's resume, and they're really getting them to talk about their last experience. And human nature and our subconscious, you always fall back on that thing that is freshest in your mind and that thing that you have the most expertise on.
So you're going to talk. If you're working on a project that is confidential and you're in an interview and they're really interested, you're going to talk about some of the neat things that happened in that project because you really want to get the job.
You really want to get the job, and then there are just some, you would even call them, in some circles, pickup artist techniques to get people to talk, such as self-silencing. You see a lot of reporters will do this where they ask a question, you give an answer, they don't say anything. You're nervous that you have not impressed them, so you fill that in with more information. Or you repeat information back to them incorrectly. Your company makes purple teddy bears. That's really great. No, my company makes data boards, and what I was trying to explain is this, this, and this. So in addition to how they target the people to get information from, once they have them, there's even more social engineering tactics to get those people talking and keep them talking.
Well, how common is this? Is this happening to all sorts of companies, big and small? And is it pretty much happening to all companies?
I can't speak for all companies. I can say I've never seen in any of my past experience where the company that we were asked to look at, and just for the record, I've never engaged in these practices, but backing off of that, I've never seen a company that we were asked to look at that was not a household name. And it also transcends products. I mean, it goes from pharmaceuticals to food and beverage to, you know, San Francisco-based startups. I've even seen retirement associations hiring competitive intelligence companies. And now even we're seeing a lot of nonprofits, activist groups who want to be, you know, the number one activist group are even hiring these type of companies.
Well, let's say a major corporation brings you in. What are the common things that they would bring you in for?
Typically what's going to happen is, and let me just be clear, are you asking what they would bring us in for?
Because yeah,
they're
like,
an incident response.
So give me an example of like when a major corporation would bring you in and what you would do.
Okay, so there's 2 to 3 major reasons they bring us in. Typically, it's when they cannot explain why they are losing market share in a certain region.
So suddenly it's just weird, like some weird anomaly.
Those type of things. They, they may be losing market share in a region or a certain product line. No one's left the company. There's no new entrants out there. There's no new products competing with, yet they're still losing market share severely. We actually just got a case like this, and they want to figure out why. So our first step would be to, you know, socially penetrate them, socially engineer and socially hack their company in a penetration test, to identify the weak spots. And then based on that, we can conduct an investigation and figure out which employees, or even sometimes which postings, which tweets, which LinkedIn profiles are giving way to information theft. And most of the time, almost all of the time, companies don't realize that they're their own worst enemy.
Oh, that they might be doing it without even realizing. So is it just information that would cause market share loss? Because I would think they'd have to have somebody else would have to have a competing product, or their people are selling their product under the table. You know, because...
Oh, without it...
Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say, yes, you're absolutely right. I mean, obviously, to lose market share, you have to have a competing product. But when you have a competitor that's picking up market share with an inferior product at the same price point, people want to know why. And sometimes that's gaining access to client lists and then undercutting the larger competitor's price. Sometimes it's a larger competitor finding out when a new entrant is setting up and then flooding the market with cheaply priced premium equipment. It's any number of things. And sometimes it's even targeting the top executives at a company or the top engineers, luring them away from a company, and then launching their own product with this, all-star team now at the more aggressive competitors that can call.
And people do that all the time. They're just, that's natural competition. It's when they cross the line and get illegal information and do it that it's considered corporate espionage, right? I mean, because part of competition is trying to steal people's employees and trying to come up with ways to compete. Mm-hmm. It's just when they do it in a way that's getting to their private information. So
exactly. And, you know,
go ahead.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I want to hear you.
I was going to say, sure. I was going to say, and what happens, I mean, companies that are practicing ethical, market behavior, typically what they'll do when they bring in a top engineer or they bring in a top executive, that person's a wealth of knowledge about their competitor. So out of respect for the NDA, the non-disclosure agreement, or the new employee may have signed with their former employer, they'll put them on a status we used to call radioactive, where they won't put them on any projects for about a year. That way that information is not fresh. There's no danger of the hiring company crossing the line of economic espionage. But we're seeing that less and less because competition across many industries is getting so tight. And you'll never find this in writing. No one will ever admit to this. But from our experience, what we've seen is, how do you guys do that? What were you working on? Well, now they're part of the team, and it's just a natural thing. They just start talking.
Sure. Well, do foreign corporations pay significant sums to steal? I mean, are you seeing a lot of foreign corporations coming in and trying to steal information from our domestic companies?
I see more domestic companies trying to steal information from domestic companies, to be quite honest with you.
Really? So it's more internal. Do you see domestic companies trying to steal from foreign companies?
I guess the way to answer that is most of the companies we dealt with are multinational companies. They may have their headquarters in Western Europe. They may have their headquarters in the U.S. or even Canada. But they have divisions and large headquarters across multiple countries. So it's not a really clear-cut answer to give you. It's less about regional and it's more about products.
I see. So basically, you're seeing more coming from domestic companies, but those domestic companies are all over the world. So it's as we become more of a multicultural, all over the world type environment, we're getting all the culture of the world mixed into our environment. And there's a lot of different cultures and places that they just don't have the same, corporate espionage would just be the way you go. You do anything you can to make it, right? You do everything goes in business and war kind of thing. And if I have to do this to get competitive, I'm doing it. And that's the culture that is kind of happening. And do you think that's penetrating back into the United States as well?
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, what we've seen, some competitive intelligence companies, a lot of them will outsource to third parties who are not under the same rules, which does two things. It gives deniability to the hiring competitive intel company, but it also puts a cushion and a layer of protection between what's happening on the ground in terms of intelligence collection and the end client. Back to your point, you're right. Most countries are not beholden to the same, protections that we have and, most Western nations have. And so what we've even seen, I even witnessed at a trade show where one tactic of a particular country, I won't name which one, will literally flood a stand, a booth at a trade show and just grab as much information as they can. We are talking 20 people, just like a swarm, taking pictures, doing schematics, and they're being chased out by that booth's hired security.
Wow. Yeah, they do it, and they just do it openly because it's commonplace.
Yeah, I mean, what are you going to do? I mean, you cannot, especially if it's in their own country where the trade show is occurring. And that also brings up another important point. Trade shows are just probably the busiest hotbeds of corporate espionage out there. It's a great place to recruit assets, and it's also a great place to get information, because why do you send people to a trade show to talk about the product? All you have to do, any, you know, social hack or any social engineer will tell you, if you get them talking, you have them. They are going to reveal enough. And it's not they're going to get that one source with all the information. I call it triangulation. They're going to interview, as we say, multiple sources and start overlaying everything they've learned. And that, in the center of that apex, that's where the intelligence lies. That's where the truth lies.
Well, how much does this cross over into government? Like, how much do, you know, the CIA is a spy agency. I mean, how much does this cross over into the government agencies actually doing it?
You know, quite honestly, I couldn't really, nor would I speak for that or speak to that. But, you know, there's only so many ways to gather information. So I would just probably say perhaps.
Well, and I'm not even trying to accuse the CIA. I'm saying there's other governments around the world that might be doing that, you know, because they want a competitive advantage for their country. And so they could be sponsoring a lot of that, because that's their lifeblood, right?
Yeah. Every country in the world wants to know not only what their enemies or the neutral, but also what their allies are doing. We've seen many cases. As a matter of fact, I'm working on several papers that really kind of just pull from the headlines what's going on, where you can see it. And there's engineers in an American company that are caught working for a foreign government. There was a banker in New York recently who is currently on trial being accused of being a spy to a foreign country. So based on what I've seen just in the press and the fact that, I mean, let's face the facts, if you look at the resumes of a lot of people in this field, most of them do come from some sort of government or quasi-government training and experience. So I think a lot of the crossover may mainly be in methodology and bringing that methodology into the commercial world, which if you're only a business trained person or you're an engineer or you're a salesperson, how do you defend against that? How do you defend against someone who's that highly trained to get information out of people?
Well, yeah, and you don't know. Well, I mean, let's face it, banking, energy, the military, different corporations that supply to the military. I can't imagine that other, you know, other governments wouldn't want that information. You know, because a lot of what a government does is privately sourced. Go ahead.
Yeah, and, you know, and I would say, you know, one thing I have seen, and, you know, not to defend any of the governments that I've been familiar with, but one thing I have seen is there are things in place where they actually do share as much as they can, because among defense contractors, what you do see is, yes, they compete on this product, but they're teamed on this product. They compete for this contract, but they're teamed on this contract. If you look at here in the Beltway, most defense contractors have two teams that they'll go after a proposal with. They'll have a prime team and a sub team. That being said, on their prime team, which are going for the lion's share of the contract, you know, Company X may be partnered with Company Y as their sub. Whereas their sub team, who's just going after being a sub on that contract, should they lose the prime bid, may be partnered with Company R. So you see a lot of crossover that way, and that seems to naturally play down the instances of cross corporate espionage in those fields, but it definitely doesn't make them immune to it. So, you know, what I always tell people is, you know, if you don't think you're being spied on, you probably are.
Well, I would think the more sensitive your stuff is, the more likely you are, or the more the dollar amount that you're in and how impactful your products are, the more likely you are as well. I mean, if you have if you have a breakthrough technology and energy, I can't imagine you're not going to be spied on. you know, or if you have a breakthrough technology anywhere. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, of course. And that's definitely, you know, definitely the case. But one thing that, you know, Sari, you hit on something that we talk to a lot of our clients about. The first thing they say is, well, we don't have any breakthrough technologies. We're pretty open about our product and our operations. Why would anyone spy on us? And the thing people, corporations, businesses need to remember is you will never know what they're interested in. You may think they're interested in that breakthrough technology. They may just be interested in the engineering team you have on a completely different product. So it's a pitfall. It's definitely something to keep in mind. Yes, if you are coming out with a breakthrough technology, you have to tighten everything up. You have to make sure your security is sound. But at the same time, where a lot of companies fall into trouble is they're so focused on the breakthrough technology, or they're so focused on this new market, this new product line, that they tend to ignore the other parts of their business. And it may be something completely innocuous to the company, but completely valuable to the competitor that the competitor is actually after.
So it could just be a simple thing like the customer list or what your pricing strategies are.
Something like that, or you may be in contract negotiations with one of your allies, per se, and they may want to torpedo that contract negotiation so they gain access to your company to gain sensitive data regarding those negotiations leading up to that contract, publish them on the internet as if they are one of those companies, which essentially torpedoes a deal, especially if it violates any regulation such as the SEC would have.
Well, I would think, you know, at the SEC, there's lots of insider training that goes on. So people who, if they have a big play that they're making, a pharmaceutical company or something like that, maybe do you see brokerage houses and you know, there would be motivation for investment companies to do it as well?
You know, in my own experience, I have actually not run across investment companies doing a lot of this.
Well, maybe they get that naturally. They might just get it without having to work at it.
You know, they maybe, you know, they probably figure it into the risk in the stock price. But, you know, quite honestly, I've never really worked with any investment companies that were engaged in this sort of thing. And, you know, that makes a lot of sense because they're under such scrutiny, especially hedge funds these days. They're under such scrutiny that to take that kind of risk is just devastating to them. Most of the companies that we've dealt with and have helped defend themselves against this, you know, they tend to be producing a product, producing a tangible product, whether that's a medical product, whether that's a agricultural piece of equipment, sometimes whether it's a new type of soda. It just depends on, you know, but product companies tend to use this the most. And I think the reason why that is, it's the easiest intelligence to make actionable, and it's also the easiest intelligence to gain.
Well, what are some of the ways that the bad guys undermine institutions? And I'm talking, you know, probably business and government, mostly business. How do they undermine their credibility? Are there things that they do beyond just corporate espionage? Are there things that they do as far as making companies look bad?
Oh, absolutely. We have seen that many times. One major practice is what we call spoofing executives, where you set up social media as if you are the executive, and then you start linking in and following and tweeting on and following things that go against the culture of your company, things that go against the, you know, the cultural sensibilities of your company, things that basically make you look bad. For instance, you know, maybe it could be, I don't know, a donut company who is on a paleo website talking about the dangers of carbohydrates. I mean, just as a more humorous example, but we've seen that a lot. We call that spoofing. And then there's a practice that's going on. We actually just cracked a big case, which they call short and distort. And that's where people on the OTC, the over-the-counter market for the penny stocks, what they're doing is they're hiring internet trolls to go out and literally spread false information about a company because they've already sold that company short. And
because
the stocks are so small. And so we've actually cracked a lot of short and distort cases.
Well, how do you do that? As a normal person, how do you, you know, it'd be confusing. There's so much internet information out there you don't know. Yeah, how can you tell the difference?
Well, you got to hire us. I'm kidding.
No, but a normal person, you're running into all sorts of stuff, and you don't know. I mean, it could be a sophisticated campaign, too, I would imagine.
Well, the one thing, it can be. But, you know, a couple things we always tell people is, you know, to really detect this on your own, if you want to do this on your own, you know, first and foremost, do your homework. There's so many people that just don't do their homework. There's so many people when we're doing a penetration test for a company, never actually look at our website. They never Google the address and see that it's full of trees. And this happens more times than not. And we're talking very sophisticated people that we've talked to never take the time to just do the fundamental homework of why is this person calling me? Why is someone saying there's an FBI raid? Well, let me call the FBI. Let me look at popular media. Let me look at a major newspaper. And that story's not appearing. People just aren't doing that. And for whatever reason, I cannot explain to you, but probably because they're so enamored with their choice of a stock, or they just don't do the homework. I mean, a lot of people just literally do not look at the details.
Do you think people are trusting? Do you think people are just trusting, or just we don't have enough time?
I think it's a, it was said that it's a 10-minute nation. Well, it's a 10-minute world. And people are moving fast, especially day traders. It's momentum trading. And they're just not doing the research. And I think that's the biggest thing. Most people that I know, inside my world and out are not trusting at all. But, you know, sometimes it can be intellectual laziness. If you're going to put your money into something, I don't care if you're buying a $20 lunch or you're buying a $100,000 group of shares on a stock, do your homework, and that's your money. Find out, you know, is this story true? Another thing that you can do too, and we do this all the time, the very first thing we look at is who owns the site? If it's a popular site, are they required to register? What's the IP address? You know, really, and then of course, what's the motivation behind it? Why would someone want to tank the stock? And then you just do some, you know, backwards navigating, and you can usually find out who the culprits are based on that.
Oh, interesting. So are your you finding your services being in really high demand right now?
Our services are getting in really high demand, especially since, I mean, really it started back with the Aramco hack a few years ago. And then since then, we're doing a lot of work to really get some awareness out there of, you know, what we're doing, vice what, you know, social hacking is in the popular internet. So a lot of people think social hacking is calling someone and getting them to reveal, you know, the shift schedule or the password. And that's, you know, that could be valuable information for a bad guy. But what we're really trying to show people is this isn't, you know, a couple rogue spies out there trying to get secrets. This is an industry with statements of work, with contracts, with retainers, a lot of times hired through a firm's outside counsel. And so that's what we're trying to show people is, you know, this is what it is. So to answer your question, we're in really, really high demand because what I do for companies is I'll do what they call a lunch and learn. I'll talk to the executives via Skype or in person. It just depends. And when I tell them, I terrify them, and I'm terrifying them because I've done this. I have seen these practices tried and true. And so then what's happening is once I show them that, then I show them the solution. And then what I try to do and my team tries to do is get with the company and not train them or not dazzle them with some great training, but train the trainer so this becomes part of their culture.
Oh, that's the most important thing, I would think, because the people need to know what to do to safeguard themselves. Well, what are the things that businesses can do to safeguard their intellectual property and other assets? I know we're just talking about that now. What are some of the things that you train people to do?
One of the things we train people to do is really have strict rules about social media. The other thing we train people to do is bring your HR team into your defensive posture. Make sure they're on the resume websites, Monster, Yahoo, all good websites, not saying anything bad about them. But, you know, make sure people aren't putting too much on their resumes. I worked in a certain field for certain clients where we were not allowed to post a resume until it went through a special editorial review to make sure they're not revealing company secrets or even the direction a company's going. That's the very first thing people can do. And you have to, you know, I think the biggest thing we teach companies, going back to what I said, is this, you have to practice. This has to be part of your culture. This is like working out. You just don't go to the gym for 5 weeks and then you stop and you stay, you know, you're buff for the rest of your life.
Oh gosh, I wish that was the case. Go ahead.
What's that?
I said, I wish that was the case.
Yeah, and that's,
I had to do my exercises this morning, and I do it every morning, and this morning I just like, oh God, I don't want to do it. Anyways, go ahead.
And yeah, and that's the thing. And what, you know, and when it comes to these type of practices, after we teach people, they're saying the same thing. Oh, I don't want to do this. It's just, it's early. I was out too late last night. I'm just going to send this over my Gmail to my buddy because it takes so long to log into the company mail. Or, well, I'm not supposed to do this. I'm just going to take the company laptop home tonight and work on my desktop. Well, you have to. And what we, you know, what we're in business to do is not only make individuals or, you know, organizations or nonprofits, but especially businesses. We want to make them harder targets. And the only way to be a harder target, meaning a target that's hard to get information from, is to make security part of your culture. We used to have a saying at my friend Gary Oliver's business that security is not an overhead. Well, the problem we're seeing is when it comes to security at companies, they think you hire a uniformed security service and your secrets are protected because no one can leave the building. Or they'll assign someone additional duty in business development or in the engineering department and say, oh, hey, you're also supposed to look out for corporate espionage. What we're not seeing is, this needs to become a regular business practice. And look, for the companies that are very successful and very large, they've been doing this for years. We don't get them as clients because a lot of them have this in place. They'll bring us in to test their own teams, but they know it. They figured this out a long time ago, especially in pharmaceuticals.
Oh,
but
I'm sure.
But there's a lot of companies.
And yeah. Especially as you go into other countries all over the place, if they're a global corporation, that's just part of doing business in some of these other countries.
Exactly, exactly. Well, and you know, go ahead, I'm sorry.
Well, go ahead. No, I was going to move on to another question. So if you have something more to say about that, go ahead.
The other thing I'd say, too, is going back to what I said earlier on in this conversation, the number one thing we hear from clients all the time, well, why would anyone want to spy on me? Well, that's a trick. You don't know. You don't know why they'd want to spy on you. So why wait until you're shutting your business down than to find out now? And we even had a very high-end members-only dinner club in a major city come to us, and they're like, hey, you know, we think the North Koreans are hacking us because they were premiering a certain popular movie that was the subject of much controversy, you know, for their guests that night. But what it turned out to be was, even at that level, don't get me wrong, great, great dinner place. But, you know, this was an ex-employee who had set up his own restaurant and was hacking the client list. And when we went in there, what we noticed was that it was wide open. I walked in, the doors were open. And you know, now not only is that club still one of the best clubs, I think, in the world, and definitely the best steaks in the world and the best service in the world, but they're taking it seriously now. They're being careful with their menus. They're being careful with their client list. And it's actually increased their business, and it's actually really increased their profit margin, because guess what? They're not losing clients. They're not wasting mental energy worrying about where their secrets are going or worrying about the wrong enemy. I mean, worrying about a state actor attacking a restaurant, that's wasted energy. And if you're focused on the big, you know, the boogeyman to the right, you may miss the, you know, the gremlin on your left. And that's what we teach people.
Wow. Okay. Well, what can individuals do to protect their financial assets? Because it's not just businesses, right? It's also corporate executives. It's anybody with high wealth or anybody that might have secrets they want to keep private.
You know, the biggest thing, one thing I've learned is, my credit card's been hacked. I don't really know anyone who has at one point not had an incident with a credit card or a bank card. The number one thing you need to do is, and again, these corporations, is when I wake up in the morning, okay, I'll do some exercise, a little less now than when I was younger, but I'll do some exercise, and then I'll brush my teeth, and then I will put on my tie, and then I'll go to work. But one thing I also do is I check my email. If I go to my Gmail, I check which IP addresses I've accessed to. And then I go through my checking account. I go through my credit card statement every single morning because I want to catch something if it's already happened and report it immediately. And that's, most people don't catch these things until it's thousands have been taken from them. So it goes back to you have to make it part of your personal, part of your private, part of your corporate, part of your organizational culture to incorporate defense into your mindset.
And once you notice there's a breach that happens, should you contact authorities or what should you do? Let's say you notice that someone's, you know, took your credit card identity. Obviously, you call the credit card company right away, but then do you also contact authorities or what do you do?
Well, I mean, a lot of times you have to. A lot of banks will say you need to get a police statement. But I'll tell you, unless it's a huge sum of money,
they don't care.
You know, it's not that they don't care, but they're overwhelmed.
Sure.
You know, they cannot chase down every $1,000 or $2,000 lead. They just can't do it. There's hundreds of thousands of them. But, you know, you still have to report it. A lot of companies will make you do that. But what you also need to do as well is if you get hacked, because the way this works, you know, people hack people's identities. The hackers aren't the ones taking the money. They're selling
information
to criminals. And then criminals are, you know, taking this. So the key thing is, you know, if this happens, yes, report it to the authorities, call the bank first, call the institution first, but then check out all your other accounts. Check out not only your email and your credit cards, check out your United account. Find out when the last login was there. Check out your air miles. See if people are cashing them in because everything is a point of entry. One funny story, if I can share it with you.
Yeah.
You know, I had an incident where, you know, one of my partners said, hey, did you add an outside account to the business account? I said, no. And I looked and there was this bank I'd never heard of that had been attached to my account for a future transfer. The only thing that hadn't happened was verification of that account. Once that was allowed to happen, they could have transferred my whole account to this other bank account. And
Oh, geez. So
thank God that it wasn't a especially genius doing this because he used his own email, which was, FinFin, it's something at yahoo.com. I don't remember the exact thing. And so when I found that out, you know, doing investigations, I was able to make some calls, use our access, use our databases, and use our know-how to track it down to a guy who just got out on parole, from a violent crime stint, and find out where he lived. I even found out his location because I set up an email that said account verification services at soandso.com, just using a commercial site. He clicked on it. That gave me his general location. And I just went down through all the files, anyone attached to that email that I found on social media, got it right down, and I actually called his parole officer and was able to turn this information in. And I couldn't resist Sarah. You know, I'm that kind of guy. I actually sent him an email and I said, hey.
You had to contact him directly. I might contact somebody like that directly too, except you actually are trained, and I'm kind of a stupid, clumsy person that would contact him anyways. The next thing I know, I'd be in trouble.
Well, I'm probably the stupid guy for, you know, kicking the beehive. But you know what? I mean, the way, you know, I've always lived by one thing. It's like, you know, if you want peace, prepare for war. And my thing was with him, I wanted him to know. I wanted him to feel the fear of how this can come back. I wanted him to know why his parole officer was coming to get him because the way I saw
it
was – Yeah, he'll think twice next time he buys that information. And I call, you know, I basically said, hey, FinFin, you failed. Now, I didn't use fail. I used another word, but I won't say that on your show. But, you know, that must have been a long night for him.
You know,
to say the least.
There's a funny story that I got it. You had a funny story. I'm going to tell a funny story. There's an article that I was reading about some of the old time services that, you know, like the landlines that weren't all digital and things. And even money, just paper money. If all this stuff would have been, you know, we say it is old fashioned, you know, everything is old fashioned, getting online and stuff is kind of the way to go. But if the old fashioned stuff was introduced later and it was never existed, like this was all first and then these old fashioned, things came into existence, everybody think they're the greatest thing since sliced bread. These are great because you can't hack into
it.
You can't, you know, it's just now we see it as the old way of doing things. But if it was introduced now when we didn't know about it, we'd think they were amazing. But.
Oh, absolutely. But you still got to be careful of that too, because never forget, you know, there are still people that will break into offices. That European restaurant I was talking about earlier, they had a lot of stuff on bulletin boards that was very sensitive, and they left their doors open. And, you know, yes, I agree with you. But remember, too, if you're going to go old school and do paper, make sure you keep track of where that paper is and do not put it on display.
Oh, yeah, because that's so easy, just little notes or something. Well, you know, what can people do to learn more?
People still dumpster dive.
Oh, yeah, you got to, that's bad. But it's just become so overwhelming to take care of your stuff, you know, to always shred and to always, that's why you said it has to become a way of life. But where can people, go ahead, do your last thing, and then I want to know where people can go to learn about your services.
Sure, and I was going to say one thing about that. One thing that's really important, look, if you come to us, great, we want to help you. I mean, we love being in this business because we believe in fair business. We believe in fair practice. And with all these skill sets that I've learned, my team has learned through their career, why should the bad guys be the only people that have access to this information, to this training? Our goal is to level the playing field.
Well, yeah,
if
the bad guys get all this training and the good guys don't, we're just sitting ducks.
Exactly. And, you know, a lot of people get in the training are good guys. I'm a good guy. I got the training.
Oh, you're just saying that. How do we know you're a good guy? I'm kidding.
Well, my mom says I'm special. But, you know, really what we... What we teach people is, you know, the people who have this training, and let me just specify that, they're not leaving their organization saying, I can't wait to do some, I'm sure there's a few are, you know, I've never met them, thank God. But, you know, it's more about economy. You know, if you cut 400,000 people's clearances in the same week, they got to find work. And a lot of times, even they don't know who they're working for. So it's more like, these skill sets are out there. So what we're trying to do is create awareness to almost create a new economy, because that's going to do two things. It's going to create a fair and level playing field for businesses and private individuals just trying to live their daily lives. But it's also going to drain that pool from the nefarious actors that would normally have access to those skill sets.
Sure. Well, okay, so where can people go to learn about your services? And we'll have this information up on our radio page and on my website as well, but what is the best way for people to go and learn more?
Sure, well, yeah, so we have two organizations. What we have is StrikerPierce.com. That is our flagship company. We do everything from investigations to training. All of our clients for investigations get free consultations after their product, after their investigation is over, in case an incident happens. But that's StrikerPierce.com, StrikerPierce. If you're an individual, you want to look at investigations. If you're a corporation or a business, you want to look at corporate services. And if you don't know what you want, give us a call, because a lot of our job is, a lot of times we have to explain to people really what their problem is, because a lot of people don't know. And then for activism and nonprofits, especially activists who are going to very dangerous areas, a lot of them cannot afford adequate training for counterintelligence or even for security. And we just started a new nonprofit that just got approved, and that's called the AILA Foundation. You know, which is really, AILA comes from a large tree and providing shelter. And what we've done with that is we're bringing a lot of these people who are looking for that work, as long as they pass our very rigorous screening and we know they're on the, you know, on the right side. You know, we're trying to make that available for nonprofits so they can have access to that training. Yeah. And
we can't, if it's all
right now, but it is.
That's wonderful, because if everything's always about, if you don't have the money, you don't, you know, too bad, because activism and things that are good to change the world, you never get, you know, make things better. There's never money. There's never money behind that stuff. So if you can help people keep doing their stuff, that's great.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And look, we're the kind of business that, you know, we're in business to be in business. We have to make a living too. But the thing about, you know, if you are not sure, give us a call. If we can help you on the phone, you know, help you help yourself, we're going to do that first. We do not like taking business if we think you could solve the problem yourself. But again, you know, if you're just not sure, give us a call. We'd be happy to talk to you. We've done 1,000+ cases.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today, and I will have your information up on my radio page.
Well, we're looking forward to that, and we hope to hear from you again.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Brian. Have a great day.
You as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
If you have any comments or suggestions on show ideas, make sure you send me an email or make sure you comment on the shows that I have up on my website. I do read every single comment, and I do try to reply to them. And I would like to hear more about what you think about this stuff. So go to my website, sarahwestall.com, and get me some information on what you think. And again, Brian O'Shea's information will be up there if you want to see how to reach him and his company. So for now, have a wonderful day.